turn in your Bibles to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, that would be wise. We're continuing on this series of when does a boy become a man, and I have tried to emphasize that being an adult is not the same thing as being a man. Nature will take care of adulthood, but only proper, careful thinking and training will develop a man. Only when a young boy develops certain convictions that begin to guide them will they understand what manhood really looks like. And so I'm trying to take my time here because of how important of a subject it is. Now, in all of this, I could easily come under the charge of creating just simple moralisms. And I don't want that to be the case. And so I want to remind you again that all of this matters not one bit if you don't have Christ. I'm not talking about these things of what it looks like to be a man simply to raise up nice guys. I'm trying to raise up godly young men who are going to take risks for the sake of the gospel, who are going to step out and strive to do hard things for the sake of the gospel, because they recognize that they have been richly saved by their Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. It is coming not from a moral perspective. It's not coming from a humanistic perspective. It is coming from a Christian perspective, that at the very core, at the very center of it, and at the very foundation of it is Jesus Christ. All of us are born in sin. All of us are by nature rebels. All of us have, as the Bible said, gone astray. We do not honor our Lord. We do not love Him. And apart from the saving work of Jesus Christ, where we become aware of our sin, the vastness of that sin, the greatness of that sin, where we recognize that we are rightly under the wrath of God, because He is our God and Creator, and we do not care for Him. As the book of Romans says, we do not honor Him as God, nor do we give thanks to Him as God. Rather, we give thanks to the creatures and creation around us. We stand then condemned, without hope, except for the fact that God, in His rich mercy, sent forth His Son into the likeness of man, that He might be a sin bearer, that He would take our sin upon Him, which He did at the cross, that He fully bore that wrath that was ours to have, and He saved us. We are saved not by our own works, but by simple trust, simple faith in Jesus Christ. It all starts there. You know this gospel so well. Some of you may not believe this gospel. For some of you, you're still perhaps trying to do the right thing, and it will condemn you to hell and God's wrath for all eternity. It is not something that is a joke. It is not a side issue. It is a central issue, being right with God, your Maker and Creator and Sustainer. All that you possess, everything that you have, is a gift from Him. And it is only when you come to Him and worship Him and see Him through Jesus Christ and because of what Jesus Christ has done, His death as your sin offering, His resurrection as your hope of eternal life, that you have hope. So I want that made very clear. Without Jesus Christ, everything that I'm saying over these next several weeks is simply meaningless. But if you have Christ, if you have come to that point where you have submitted your heart to Him, that He is your Lord, He is your God, He is your Savior, then all of this means much to you. Keep that always in mind. We don't want good moral children. What we want are young men who live in the fear and the knowledge of Jesus Christ and follow Him. With that in mind, my sermon outline started with simply this: you become a man when you have the spiritual maturity to lead a wife and children. First and foremost, you have to have that. So fathers of young boys, that's what you're training into them. You have to develop that rich theology in your own life that pours and drips and flows and soaks into your home, so that when you do things, it's because of a theology, a right theology, a right understanding of God. And you want to put that into your hearts, the hearts of your children, your boys. You want them to be literally soaked in it, so that they ooze a rich theology, a rich understanding of God. One that is not merely theoretical, not because you don't want a son who can beat people up with their theology. You want somebody who can bless people with their theology. You want them to be a joy to listen to. You want them to know why they're doing what they're doing and why they're not doing what they're doing. And it needs to be centered in the Word of God. So you want to train this young man to become spiritually mature. For young men who are now men, if you're lacking in this, it means you have to be a student of the Word. You have to grow. You just simply have to put away other things and start to read and study and contemplate issues that matter, issues that are eternal. Secondly, last week I said another mark of a boy becoming a man is having that personal maturity that is sufficient to be a responsible, key word, a responsible husband and father. It is easy, very, very, very easy to be a husband and a father. It is very natural to become a husband and father, but a responsible husband and father is a whole different issue. You want to train your sons to be that way. There are many wives in this land of ours who ache because their husband is not personally mature. He's still a little boy. And what he married was not a wife that he was to care for, protect, provide, and to lead. What he married was a mom. Somebody to clean up after him and wipe his face and make certain his tummy is full. You don't want that. You want to be a young man who is spiritually mature. An immature adult is never a good thing, but for a man, it's a terrible thing because the man is created by God to inherently lead. It is what a man does, and he should have no fear in leading. But when he is so timid, so weak, so fearful, so lazy that he cannot lead, all he does is becomes a burden for that woman and for those children. I want to clarify something that I said. I received some criticism that I asked for, but I received criticism on my sermon from last week that something I said was clunky, and I would agree with that assessment. So let me try to unclunkify that. You can jot that word down. Unclunkify my intention in my illustration, and hopefully it will be helpful to you. I try when I teach parenting and when I tell young parents how to parent and talk them through all of that, I try to emphasize a principle-based approach to parenting, not a rule-based. It's very easy to create all kinds of rules, and after a while, your home just becomes filled with rules, and you can't keep track of them. Some of you parents know exactly what I mean. And as a result, what happens is when you do remember them, all of a sudden you come down on your child really hard because you remember, hey, I told you you weren't supposed to do that. But then 3 weeks later, you've forgotten that in the myriad of all the other rules, and you end up failing to discipline or train your child in the way that they should go. As I said last week, there are only two commands in the New Testament for your children: obey and honor. Those are my principles. That's how I enter into all aspects of my parenting, even now. Still, I have my son in my home, and I expect him to obey me when I ask him to do something. It's that simple. That's the principle. My question is always in my mind, does this child obey me? Did they obey when I told them to do this or to do that or not to do this? The question is very simple. Ask yourself, has my child obeyed? If not, then they need to be taught. And they need to be disciplined and trained so that they learn to obey. This starts at a very, very early age. You don't put this off. You don't say, well, I don't want to do any of this until they're 2, 3, 4, whatever. At some point, they have to learn to obey. And the earlier that you teach them what it means to obey, the better off you will be and they will be. But the second aspect is respect. If you can teach your child to respect, at first, when they're really little, all that means is a lot of obedience. Because they're just little guys. They don't really know a whole lot. My children were taught to stay out of the kitchen. And I think I said last week that I would catch my little Nikki crawling up to the kitchen and then putting her finger on the kitchen floor and looking at me to see if I saw that. And I always saw that. And when I saw that, she also got the just deserts of me seeing that. I wanted my child to learn to obey and to not harm themselves. But as they started to get a little bit older, and I'm talking where they can listen to your voice and understand your words very clearly, you can reason with them, you're training them to respect. What that means is you don't have to have a lot of rules in your home. You just simply have to teach them that when they're playing with mommy's pots or pans, If you tell them, don't play with mommy's pans, then they'll play with the pots. And you'll say, I thought I told you not to play with those pots. No, you just said pans. And they'll just keep working the rules. And they'll learn how to work around the rules. They'll play the game of a Pharisee, a legalist. They're good at it, just like you're good at it. But when you ask them, or rather when you train them to learn to respect mother's things, or father's things, or sister's things, all of a sudden you don't have to play the rule game. You just simply look at them and say, did your sister tell you you could play with those? No, that's disrespectful. You don't do things that, or you don't play with things that are not yours. You don't use things that are not yours without permission. That's being disrespectful. And you start at that point. And what will happen is, by the time they're about 4, 5, 6, they will not be thinking about rules, because rules are something you always work around. They'll start thinking in the principle of being respectful. And that's a joyful little boy or girl to have around you. One who can come into your home and they understand that it's not their home, and they would be disrespectful to mess with things in your home. And so they simply do what they're supposed to do because they want to respect. As they get older and older, this flows into their workplace. This flows into their social activities. They live with a mindset that they are to express honor. They are to express respect. Does that make sense? It's very simple. And it keeps you sane. You expect them to obey, and you expect them to respect you. And that's not just saying yes, sir. Even though, I might add, that's another free thing. Teach your kids to say yes, ma'am, and yes, sir. You don't have to listen to me on that, but I have never heard any of you complain that my children look at you and say yes, ma'am, and yes, sir. Not one. Now, I've been corrected by Casey. I have to call Casey Casey now, not sir. But that was just part of my life and upbringing, to look at an individual and just treat them with simple respect. When our children were told to do something, we expected them to respond with a yes, ma'am, or a yes, sir, or they were corrected immediately. I do not want my children to be known with saying yeah. Even to this day, I look at my Becca and she's not there, so I can't use her. Even to this day, if they do that, I give them a look and they say, yes, sir. They change. It's like, I want them to be that way. It's always easier to become more familiar, but it's very hard to become more respectful once you've been disrespectful. So just something to think about. These ideas of living in the realm of principles rather than just simple rules. It is wonderful when you raise up a young man who starts to think this way. What is it that I'm supposed to be doing? Rather than, how can I get around what I'm supposed to do? Think principle. That's as simple. This means then that you have to teach your child to listen. They need to be trained to hear your voice. And again, it is something that you have to train them to do. Nothing saddens, there's several things that sadden me, so this is not the most. But one thing that saddens me greatly is when I watch a mother or father tell their child to do something, and the child just goes about their own business. And they shrug their shoulders like, well, what am I going to do? And I'm thinking, go get the kid and inform them what it looks like when you don't listen to your father's voice. Teach them that. Put that in their heart, that they are instinctively listening for the voice of their father, their mother. I remember one of my brothers had a son who never listened. And he came so close to death one day. We were out collecting rocks. My brother was a rock hound, and we were up in the mountains of Idaho, and we were up on the edge of a cliff, basically hacking away at some rocks, and his son started to walk out onto the road. It was a mountainous road, and we could see what he could not see. We saw a logging truck come down. Those guys are crazy drivers, and we could see it coming, and he yelled at his son, and his son looked up at him, shrugged his shoulders, and kept on walking out into the roadway. By God's grace, he was not destroyed. But it just burned into my heart what it looked like to not listen, to not hear the Father's voice and not to hearken. Teach your sons, teach your daughters to hear you. That means you need to speak to your children, fathers. You want them to hear your voice. You want them to want to hear your voice. That means you read stories to them. That means you praise them and you laugh with them and you joke with them. All of this designed to let them want to hear your voice. But you also have that tone that you can kick in at any point that informs the child, stop, listen, obey, go, whatever it might be. Develop that. Never, ever plead with your child, trying to beg with them that they might obey. Expect them to do it and live that way. That means then that when your child asks you a question, you should give an answer. The same thing with advice. You should be the source of their advice that they're looking for. They need it. Give them counsel. Because when you have a child who stops listening, it's always a bad thing, right? Always. In Proverbs 19:27, it says, "Cease to hear instruction, my son, and you will stray from the words of knowledge." How simple is that? You don't even have to do anything. You just have to stop doing something. You just have to stop listening. Your child just has to no longer want to listen to you as a father. And they will walk into folly. They will go astray from the words of knowledge. And there is nothing good on that part of life when they cease to listen to you. So you want to train your son, you want to train your daughter to hear. Charles Spurgeon said it very simply. No one ever slides up. They always slide down. When they stop listening and they stop hearing, what will happen is that they will begin to slide downward in their life and their actions and their beliefs, their passions. So teach your children to listen to you and then have something to say to them. Finally, with regard to these commands to children, I want to spend just a short moment on the backside of that. In Ephesians 6:4, he says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger." In Colossians 3:21, it says, "Do not exasperate your children." It is easy for us as fathers and mothers to think about teaching our children and expecting them to obey, expecting them to do certain things, but not consider what it means for us to parent them. There is nothing sadder than an angry child or a child with a broken spirit, a child who has given up. I did that to one of my children. And I remember the tears in this child's eyes. They'd given up. Somehow I had raised him into thinking there was no hope of being saved, of ever receiving grace. I had taught this child that God's sovereignty means there's no hope. And I remember disciplining my child for the umpteenth time on a situation because of stubbornness and sin. And I looked at him and I tried to speak the gospel to the child, and I'll never forget the words. "If I'm not elect, what does it matter?" And I'm like, wow. Somehow this pastor managed to teach his child not the richness of God's grace, but the evil of fatalism. There was no hope. And as his child wept and was just body-racking sobbing, my mind was just going crazy. It's like, what do I do to undo this? What do I do? And in God's mercy, I decided to try something. I said, "If you'll come over here, I'll give you a hug." And my child was just racked with sobbing. I mean, you have no idea the level that was going on there. And my child rushed into my arms, and I gave a hug, and I wept. And then I put the child up heart, and I looked into the eyes and I said, "Why did you come to me?" And there's confusion in the eyes. And then these words, "Because you said, if I would come, you'd give me a hug. And I said, that's what God says. If you'll come to Jesus, He'll save you. And that began the process of healing a broken spirit. You and I, fathers, we're good at destroying the spirits of our children, and you do not want to be that. You want to be someone who builds the spirit up. You do not want to exasperate your child. You do not want an angry son. You want one who's happy, one who's filled with mischief and joy. So how do you do that? How do you be a father who does not exasperate or provoke your child to anger? Let me give you just some free advice. One way is to become overprotective. Don't. Let your son, let your daughter play. They heal. They bounce. I'll never forget my Becca. She never did learn quick, Tom. You have to understand that. I remember her being her. She's Becca. And she was standing on the chair back in our patio. And she decided, Kim and I were in the house and we were talking or something. And all of a sudden, Becca pops up on this chair and goes, hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. And she's just being cute little Becca. And all of a sudden, she loses her balance. And we just watch her go, foomp. And I remember the noise of her head hitting the pavement. Oh, it was a terrible noise. Terrible. And I jumped over the couch and I went running out. And she was, parents, you'll remember this, in your children probably, she was not making a sound because she was still taking in more air to let out that one scream that will never be forgotten. And she just, and then she started crying. And I looked at her, I quickly checked her eyes to see if there's any indication of a concussion, anything. She was just sore. And I held her, and after a short bit, she stopped crying, and I said, well, don't go play now. So I go back in the house. That little girl, 5 seconds later, was standing on the same chair, waving at me, and I'm not joking, all of a sudden, she does it again. Bam! I'm like, you're just not smart. I love you, but come on, twice? But you know what? They bounce. Don't be overprotective. Where your child is frustrated because they don't get to do anything, don't ever play favorites. They're all your children. There can be fun children and difficult children, but they're yours, so you treat them that way. Don't compare one against the other for the purpose of manipulating them. Why can't you be like your sister? Well, because he's not his sister. She's not her sister. Every one of them is unique. Don't be a hypocrite. You want to exasperate your child, expect them to obey what you don't obey. Expect them to do what you don't do. Be one who is faithful in that and consistent. You want to exasperate your child, be inconsistent with your standards and expectations with them. It's really easy. Spank them on Monday for something that you laugh at on Tuesday. It's not good. It's always, they don't know what to do. They're always wondering, if I do this, am I going to get in trouble or not? Have a standard, have expectations, and be consistent with them. Create the boundaries. Children love boundaries. They may kick against them, but that's being a sinner. But they love boundaries. Give them clear boundaries that they get to play in. And then let them enjoy everything within those boundaries. Don't be harsh in words and actions. Now, you're going to be that way if you're like me. But you have to confess that, and you have to repent of that. Don't be harsh. Always remember that they carry in them the image of God. Right? We talked about that the very first sermon. They carry with them the image of God. Treat them then as infinitely valuable. Never be abusive. Never be. Create up an angry child, and he will be an angry man. And then you will have a heart that is broken. Today, I want to go to the next standard or expectation that you want of helping a boy become a man, and that means that he is able to express economic maturity sufficient to hold a job, an adult job, and handle money. Let me say that again. A boy to a man means that he is able to express economic maturity sufficient to hold an adult job and handle money. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, it is written, let's start in verse 9. Now as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. For indeed you do practice it toward all the brethren who are in all Macedonia. But we urge you, brethren, to excel still more, and to make it your ambition to lead a quiet life, and attend to your own business, and work with your hands, just as we commanded you, so that you may behave properly toward outsiders and not be in any need. Several principles I want to pull out of verses 10 through 12. I want you to consider this, parents, and I want you to consider this, young men and old men. Listen to these words. This is from an apostle of Jesus Christ telling us what we ought to do. First thing you want to do is teach your son to keep his mind off of others and on his own responsibilities. He says, to make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business. All of this is related to verse 1, where he says in chapter 4, finally then, brethren, we request and exhort you in the Lord Jesus that you receive from us instruction as to how you ought to walk and please God, just as you actually do walk, that you may excel still more. So Paul is now giving, in chapter 4 and following, simple, practical advice of what it looks like to walk and please God. This is what he says pleases him. That should wake all of you up and say, well, then I want to hear this. I want to understand this. This then, fathers, is what you want to pour into your son, your daughters as well, but definitely your sons, because they're the ones that will always set the tone for their home. You raise up a godly young man and he will shepherd his wife. He will shepherd his children. You raise up a lazy son and he will only tear his wife down and destroy his children. Teach your son to keep his mind off of others and on his own responsibilities. This was something that was often heard in various ways in my own home, raising up mine. Peter is a good example of what you're not supposed to do. Peter, in John chapter 21, hears these words. Jesus says to him, truly, truly, I say to you, when you were younger, you used to gird yourself and walk wherever you wish. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will gird you and bring you where you do not wish to go. All of this referencing how Peter was going to die. So what does Peter do? Peter does what a lot of people do. He then looks at John, Peter does, the Apostle John, and says, well, what about John? What's going to happen to him? I love Jesus' reply, and I have on frequent occasion encouraged people to consider what Jesus says in verse 22. He says, if I want him, John, to remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. In other words, shut up and mind your own business. What do you care about what is going to happen to John? Worry about yourself. Take care of your own business. Keep your eyes on your own responsibilities. In my home, that when I grew up, we had seven of us, and my father traveled usually 3 weeks out of a month. He was on the road because of his business. This is before the days of airline travel. So it was just my mom, Lord help her, with a bunch of boys and two girls who were terrorized by those boys. And this was what we were taught to do. It was just, and to this day, I still tend to do this. We were supposed to sit and wrap our toes around the legs of our chair, because if not, somebody was soon kicking another one. And the most common statement at our dinner table was, shut up and keep your eyes on your own plate. Because invariably somebody would do an elbow or this or that, and pretty soon it's just this little tussle, if you will. So it was always, shut up and keep your eyes on your own plate. And to this day, I still think that way. Keep your eyes on your own plate. What do you care about what your brother's doing? What do you care about what your sister's doing? You worry about your own plate and get that food eaten. That's the idea of what Paul is saying. Lead a quiet life, men, and mind your own business. There are those types of people who find it fun and easy to intrude into other people's lives, but that does not mean that it's good for them to do that. They ask questions on things that is of no concern for them. They create disturbances where peace once existed, and then they leave others to come and clean up the mess that they leave behind after destroying or creating problems. A wise son is taught to be busy about his own tasks. A wise son is taught to be busy about his own responsibilities and stay out of others. Don't worry about whether your sister's cleaning the house like she's supposed to. Have you done your chores? Have you been faithful, son? A wise son is taught to not speak unless they are first found faithful. Let me say that again. A wise son is taught to not speak about an issue unless they themselves are found faithful. They have nothing to say. They have nothing to contribute. A person who can't hold a job has nothing to say to another person about work. There's no words that should come out of their mouth. They should just not talk. A person who cannot pay their bills should be very quiet in conversations in anything related to money and finances. Their mouth should be very quiet. If you find a son who has time to intrude into other people's business, my counsel to you is give him something to do. Invent a chore. Get him busy. If he's has that much time to be waxing eloquently about what he would do, then give him something to do. Better yet, go find a chore that you can work on and invite your son or expect your son to work next to you so that he can work with dad and see what it looks like. Also, another wise thing for fathers to do in this regard is wait for that moment in your son's life, and it will come, where somebody sticks their nose into his business and he's frustrated over it, to then sit him down and show him and teach him what it's like. And say, see, this is why I'm always telling you, mind your business. Stay out of other people's business. Don't allow his opinions to wander around the house uncontrolled. Teach your son to be busy taking care of his own responsibility. All of this has to do with finances. Keep him busy on his own. I tell couples in all of my premarital and most people who come in for marital counseling to cut off the camel's nose. All of you who've been counseled by me know what I mean. The old saying is, if you let a camel stick its nose in your tent, pretty soon you're going to have a camel in your tent. So I teach the young men, cut those camel's noses off as they stick them into your home. You are creating a new home with you and your wife, and people will want to stick their nose into your business. Cut them off every time. It's not fun, it's not pleasurable, but it's very good to do. Don't allow other people to stick their nose into your business. Cut it off. But part of that also means you keep your nose out of their business, and you honor that. It is key, secondly, to teach a son, this is all being pulled out of this passage, faithfulness to a task, to see it to a finish, and to do it because it's his responsibility, which means that you want to find people who are good examples of faithful workers, faithful employees, hard workers, and speak highly of them. If you are looking for an example of what it looks like to be a hard worker in this church, I would encourage you, though he will be embarrassed, to go observe Glenn Michaelis. I've never seen a man work harder than this guy. I mean, he's just amazing. This is a man who decided that he needed a basement, so he hand dug it underneath his existing house. Now, what kind of a whack job does that? He just decided we need a basement. Out comes a shovel and a bucket, and he starts to dig it out. And if you go down there and you go into his basement, that was hand dug. That's crazy. This is a man who works a full-time job and comes home then to work several more hours on his farm. teach your son to admire that. Teach your son to respect that. Always have on your lips words of praise for those who work hard. And never, listen, this might sound mean, but never give a good word regarding those who are lazy. Never. Never give a good word about those who are lazy. You want your son to see a demeanor come over you when a person who is lazy is referenced. You want him to see a level of distaste. It doesn't have to be evil. You don't have to be mean about it. But you have to be able to convey to him that you don't respect that, because it's not respect worthy. But you also want to have your son, who is so soft and moldable when he's young, see your face beam when you speak of a man who is a hard worker, or you exhibit that yourself, or you see him do something hard. You want that. You want to put it in your son to be working hard. Show him, fathers, what unfaithfulness looks like. You don't have to be harsh, but you don't want to be vague about that. It says in Proverbs 13:4, the soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing, but the soul of the diligent is made fat. One heart desires but never gets. The other one desires and gains because he's diligent and faithful. The lazy one will always want but never receive. Point that out to him. Show him. Show him in real life what that looks like. In Proverbs 24, it says this in verses 30 to 34. I passed by the field of the sluggard and by the vineyard of the man lacking sense. See how blunt Solomon is? Be blunt like that with your son. I passed by the field of the sluggard and by the vineyard of the man lacking sense, and behold, it was completely overgrown with thistles. Its surface was covered with nettles. Its stone wall was broken down. And when I saw, I reflected upon it. I looked and I received instruction, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and then your poverty will come as a robber and your want like an armed man. Never, ever show respect toward those who are lazy. Teach your son to avoid those people. Third, teach your son the value of physical labor. He says here, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life, attend to your own business, and work with your hands. Now, I'll give a passing acknowledgement that in our society, there's a lot of jobs that are not overtly physical anymore, and that's fine. But you want to be one who works hard at those jobs. You don't want to look for a job just because it's easy. Whatever you do, you want to do it with all the vigor and energy that you can bring forth. Notice that this is a command. It is not a suggestion. Paul is commanding us to work with our hands, to be hard workers, to be busy. Listen, boys should get dirty. When they wash their hands, the sink should be brown. Their bed should have gritty material in it. You're laughing. It should. And just so you know, moms, boys are very comfortable in that. They're totally at home with grit in their sheets. And they also love it when mom gives them nice fresh ones. But let them get dirty. They should get cuts. They should bleed. I was raised to consider a day a bad day if I didn't come home with at least one cut on my body. It was just the way I was taught. It wasn't overtly taught. It was, you just got bloody. And my mom would just say, well, go wash it off. Go get a Band-Aid. Dad would always admire it. Admire your son's cuts. They're worthy of admiration. It means he did something. Allow your sons to do stupid things so they can learn what stupid results in. It's okay. Let them have a level of freedom to explore and to dream so that they learn what it means to work with their hands and do things. Don't keep them so safe that they don't ever explore and become what God intended a young man to be, one who brings dominion into his little corner of the earth.
Some love to dig, others love to disassemble, and others love to build. Some of you know what I'm talking about. I know of one father who's got a son who cannot leave things alone. He has to take them apart. I got another man in this room right now who is always wondering where one tool or another went because his son has got it. But his son is up to something, and it's something good. So it's a good thing. My son would always receive praise if he worked with me willingly and faithfully. But he received some of his harshest rebukes when he was lazy. When I'm halfway under a sink and I'm asking him to hand me something, and he's giving me that half-eyed look, you know, huh, what? It's like, I would get out from underneath the sink and I'd be in his face. It's like, boy, don't you ever make a man wait on you. Never. Work hard. You want to do a hard work? I praise you. You want to be a lazy man? I'll rebuke you. Teach that to your boys. Let them be hard workers, not afraid of that. I remember shipping them off to the uncles and his grandfather, who have an excavation business in Maryland. I sent them off for 2 different summers. I remember my words to him the first time. I said, boy, you are going to go work for men, and they work hard. I want you to make certain you're always the first one in the hole, and I want you to make certain you're always the last one out of that hole. Don't you dare make your uncles tell you twice. And he was a good worker, and he was a hard worker. It made me happy when I went there into Maryland, and we went to a job site, and down he was in the sewer. And he was basically hacking away a hole because they had to put another sewer line into this. And I loved the fact he was grimy and he stood tall and he looked at me with confidence. It's like, yes, teach your son to be a hard worker. Idle hands will always just waste a life. Again, work hard is the point. Work with your hands. But the idea is work hard, be faithful. We taught our children to be the kind of employee that when a boss was looking for somebody to do something, that child's name was always the first on his mind. We just wanted them to always think first of my child when they're looking for something to do, and always be the last name on the list when they were looking for somebody to go away. I remember Nicole. Her first job was at 15 at KFC. And I remember they called at our house wondering if she was not going to make it to work that day because she had 20 minutes before her shift started and she wasn't there yet. That is a good thing. That they're actually like, where's Nicole? 20 minutes before work, they're like, we should call because she's not here yet. She was always there a half hour early. Teach your sons that way. Make them that kind of a worker who is always thinking, I've got to get there. I've got to be at work. I've got to be ready to work. You want that in their DNA, if you will. Fourthly, teach him to behave properly with non-Christians. He says, work with your own hands just as we commanded you. For what purpose? So that, in verse 12, you may behave properly toward outsiders. Teach them to behave properly with non-Christians. Have good relations with them. That includes paying bills. That includes handling their money in a proper manner. Nothing is more frustrating than to live next to a lazy neighbor or a loud and intrusive one. Teach your son that's not the kind of neighbor that we want to be. When they kick the ball and it goes into the flower bed, be careful when they go get the ball. They treat their neighbor's property with respect. Teach them to be willing to clear the sidewalk of your neighbor with snow. If your tree's the one that dumped all the leaves in their yard, have your son go over there with you and rake them up. Help out. Teach them, again, this value of working hard and developing a good reputation with those who are outside of the church. Now, this is where it gets touchy. He says, behave properly toward outsiders and not be in any need. Let me talk to you about this. Teach your son to be incredibly slow to receive any sort of aid. Any. Listen to me on this.
It is one thing when you see a man who has worked his tail end off and sought to be faithful and do everything in his power, and yet he still gets kicked in the teeth with life. That happens. And that's painful to watch. It is a whole other thing to see one who is so quick to have a handout and to receive aid from both the church and the government. That ought not to be, not in the church. I want you to listen. He says, so that they would not be in any need. Right now in our country, over 50% of our citizens are on food stamps. 50%. I have ignorance in this with regard to the lives of you sitting here hearing this. I don't know, so I have the freedom now to be able to say what I'm going to say because I'm not speaking to anyone in particular. People live with energy assistance, food stamps, and all kinds of other government assistance when they don't need it because it's simply offered. Because somebody has told them because they make X amount that they should get this or that. It's not because they don't have money, but because if they paid it all themselves, it would limit them incredibly in how they live. And that's not right. Men should work very, 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 very hard to not receive aid from others. It's simple. It is not evil, and it is not wrong to not sleep much. You'll survive. It's not wrong to have 3-4 jobs, if that's what it takes. It's not. It's not wrong to put in 80-hour work week. Some of you, that's just life. It's not even wrong to do a 100-hour work week. It's not. It's honest labor, and it's good for you, and you have no need. Our children would always tell me about KFC and how at the first of the month, the restaurant was inundated by customers because they had gotten their welfare checks. Just inundated. In fact, their manager told me bluntly, if we didn't have the welfare people, we wouldn't be in business. That's just sad. What is always wrong is to sit on a couch with a poor job and not do anything about it. If you have a bad job, you got a bad job, welcome to it. But at least be doing something to improve yourself to get out of that bad job eventually. Always seek to improve yourself. Always seek to learn something new. I taught my children in their jobs, they're always to be learning. Always growing in skills. Always. When you receive aid from others, it should come always with great, great reluctance. An examination of your own life. Please hear me on this. Are you doing everything? This would be the question I would ask. Are you doing everything you can to provide for your household? Everything. Are you exhausting everything in your own personal ability to provide for those children and that life? Are there any choices you are making that are a hindrance to financial stability? Listen, to need food stamps, but to buy cigarettes is a simple contradiction. It's a simple contradiction. To need food stamps, but to go out to eat, even at Taco Bell, is a contradiction. To need food stamps but have an unlimited data plan is a contradiction. There was a time I was discipling a young man, and he owed another young man in this church a decent chunk of change. And he was not paying his rent, and this guy was basically covering for him. And I remember I walked out to the parking lot and I saw a bunch of the young people getting ready to go off to some Mexican joint to eat food. And this guy was there. And I told him, I says, hey, come here. Come in my office. And I sat him down and I says, are you going out to eat? And he said, yeah. And I says, have you paid this person back? No. I said, then you're not going out to eat.
How dare you go out to eat when you owe this guy money because he's covering for you? How dare you? He left the church. And I was glad to see him go. This is a young man who had been raised to take, and not consider his responsibilities in society. That's not a man. A man takes care of himself, and he provides for his wife, and he provides for his children. He does it. Not the government. It is better for your family to eat rice and beans a lot, and it comes from your labors, than from some card that the government provides for you, and you feed them that way. That's not what it's for. Not for a Christian. Be a man who works with his hands, has a good reputation with those outside the church, and does not have any need. That means that when you're raising your boys, they need to learn that they earn what they make and is never given to them. That means they need to learn to save and to learn how to budget. I want two people, if they're here, I don't see them. Justin Rader, are you here? John Monks is here. Stand, please. Oh, just stand. Two men I would recommend you go to if you struggle with money. If you need to learn how to bring your money under control, they will get you under control. They'll help you. They'll give you basically a plan to help you learn. You have to train yourself. You have to teach yourself so that you're not a man in need. Listen, if you teach your sons this early on, they won't need a college loan for most situations. They'll have already saved that money so that they can go to college, and they'll know how to work hard and go to school at the same time, because that's their life. My daughter Nicole would hear people talk about, oh, I got to go to school, I'm so tired, I'm this. And she's like, man, I'm putting in 40 plus hours a week and full-time school. What is your complaint? Teach your sons that hard work is normal and proper. For many, their faith would simply increase if they would stop seeking aid and start working harder. You would learn how to pray. Give me this day my daily bread. Instead of Uncle Sam doing it. Over in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, it says this in verses 7 through 11. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example, because we did not act in an undisciplined manner among you, nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it. But with labor and hardship, we kept working night and day so that we might not be a burden to any of you. Not because we do not have the right to do this, but in order to offer ourselves as a model for you that you might follow our example. For even when we were with you, we used to give you this order: if anyone will not work, neither let him eat. I wish people would apply that. Paul modeled to these people in Thessalonica what it looked like to be a hard worker. He had every right as an apostle and as a teacher of the word to receive payment and receive money and food. But he chose not to with these people because they needed to see a model. Some in that church had decided that Christ was going to return very soon, and they had apparently stopped working, and they were basically mooching off of all of the other faithful Christians in that church. And Paul just simply says, no. If they're not going to work, they don't eat. Let me give you a quick, simple way to help your son learn that. If he chooses to be lazy one day, don't feed him. I'm not joking. He doesn't get dinner. You're not going to starve the guy. Trust me. Don't feed him. If you didn't do his chores, well, buddy, you didn't earn your food today. I'm sorry. Let him go without lunch. Teach him what it looks like to labor for what he has earned. Let him be proud of the fact that when he goes and gets his paycheck and he spends it because he has to buy food, that he is not ashamed of that or frustrated, that that is worthy. That is good. That is admirable. Praiseworthy. God loves it when a father and a husband goes out and buys groceries with his own money. God is pleased. train a son to see that food is a reward for work. It is not a right. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8. But if anyone does not provide for his own, especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. We talked about this in our sermon series through 1 Timothy. When a person doesn't provide for his own, meaning his extended family, you find out that there's a widow, you find out whatever, you need to help her. You need to meet their needs. But most especially for your own household, Paul says you're an apostate when you don't do that. You're an apostate. You're not a Christian. Do you see how serious this is, guys? Do you see what you're raising your boy to become? You need to train him to be a man who handles his money properly and before the Lord and understands that that money is not for his pleasure and for his spending, but for the provision of others in his home and the paying of his bills and the feeding of his family. Put it, pour it, beat it, whatever, into their very soul. Model it for them. The kind of guy who doesn't provide for his own household is the kind of guy who had it modeled for him. Remember a young man, I took him out to dinner because I was going to have a hard talk with him. And he was vaguely working. And the word vaguely is key here. And he would work whenever there was work offered to him and he'd get some money. But his father, I think unwisely, but I know his father meant well, had told him, don't worry about it. I'll cover whatever you don't make. So he found it very easy that if the guy he was working with didn't have work, he would just not lose any sleep because he knew his dad would be cutting a check for him and cover what was short. And this went on for a few months, and no matter how much I had encouraged him to reconsider the wisdom of it, he did not, because why get off that gravy train, right? So I decided, okay, he's not taking counsel, so let's chew him out. So I took him out to dinner where it would be public so he wouldn't yell real loud at me when I chewed him out. So beware the next time I ask you out for dinner. We sat there, we ordered. And I asked him, what's going on? What are you doing with work? How's it going? How many hours? When was the last time you worked? This was February. He had not worked since December with this guy. There's just no work. And I said, dude, this is wrong. And I laid into him. And we talked about not providing for his own house. I said, you are not providing for your home. And he got so indignant. He says, yes, I am. My kids are not going hungry. I said, no, your dad is. Your dad's providing your home. You should be ashamed of yourself. I was like, I slapped him across the face, but he woke up. I said, tell me right now, what would you do if your dad informed you at the end of this month, I'm not paying any more for you? What would you do then? He told me very clearly what he'd do. I said, then go be a man and do it now. My hat's off to him. He took that, and I'm giving you the short version, right on the chin, like a man, got up, called his dad and said, at the end of this month, I don't want you paid for anything anymore. And he went out and started looking for a job. A real job. I was proud of that guy. Because it clicked with him. He is not providing for his home. His dad is. Are you providing for your home? Or is it government? Fathers, don't help adult children out. Tell them to go get work. The standard at Grace Community Church before you would ever receive any aid from the church is that you had to be able to prove that you invested 8 hours every day, 5 days a week looking for a job. And never, never did any of those people not fail to find employment after 1 week. Their full-time job was to get a job, and we would not help them one dime until then. Fathers, do that to your own. The last thing I want to just say is this. In 1 Timothy 6, he says, do not love money.
The love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. You need to train that into your son. You need to teach your son that money is not something to love and to yearn for. A wise father shows his son what it looks like to love money and not to love money. That doesn't mean you're poor. That doesn't mean you don't work for a raise or more income. But it does mean that you live in such a way that it exhibits generosity and freedom with your money. And that the money is not your sole decision or way you make a decision. That you're not being angry all the time because somehow something broke. Things break. You're not driven by that. You're not always carping about the fact that this is gone or I didn't make enough there. Learn to care for money, fathers, in such a way that you see it as a tool for God's glory, the expansion of His gospel into the world. That it's not there just for your own pleasure. Think about what you model to your sons, fathers. You need to model contentment, not complaint. You need to show that simplicity is desirable. You need to teach that more money does not mean more things, but it means more kingdom building. 3 million little girls worldwide are currently slaves in the sex trade as young as 5 years old. And there are ministries that expressly go to try to rescue them. Think, 5-year-old sex slave. There are billions right now outside of God's grace, and many of them have no credible Christian witness. And the only way that they will have that is if people give money. The Voice of the Martyrs has a ministry called Bibles Unbound. For $30 a month, you will cover the cost of printing 5 Bibles and then secretly smuggling them into closed countries. This is what you show your son money is for. Let them see you give. Let them see you be generous. You need to be able to show them that though you have money, it's the Lord's. And that it is in Christ that you trust. That He alone has said that He will never leave you nor forsake you. And that is sufficient. Train up boys so that when they're men, they are responsible enough to handle their finances so as to provide for their wife and their children.